Good morning. We're back with our second guest, Denise Reitz, and we're going to be talking about homesteading, and we want to find out what homesteading was. So we found out that homesteading is a creative lifestyle of self-sufficiency that involves growing and preserving foods, building infrastructure, and living frugally. This morning, we're going to take you back on the woo-woo time machine to 1978, and find out how a northern Michigan couple in their mid-20s found the courage to purchase 50-plus acres in Inland Township just outside of Honor and to begin living their homesteading dream with only the land. Our guide on this journey will be Denise Reitz, who, along with her husband Bill of 45-plus years, were the sole eyewitnesses to these events as they unfolded. Good morning, Denise. Welcome to the semi-heated woo-woo Fifth Dimension studio.
Good morning. Glad to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh, thank you for coming. So I guess we're going to try to structure this in some different segments. So we're going to start with the early days. Do you want to begin those early days, Carol?
Can you provide our listeners with a little background? Like, where did you and Bill grow up?
I was born in Detroit, and I grew up in Royal Oak, Michigan, and graduated from Troy High when my parents moved. I-75 came through and demolished our home. Bill grew up in Merrill, Michigan, a small farming town west of Saginaw, surrounded by both sides of his family, grandparents, cousins. His grandfather owned the local car dealership, and his father was raised on a farm, which is still in the family today.
Wow. So how were you connected to Benzie County?
I was first in Benzie County in 1952, the year I was born. My grandparents bought 4 acres on the north shore of Crystal Lake in 1945. It was Grandpa's idea to give his son-in-law's a place after the Second World War to recoup with family and relax and get back into the public life. And so I spent every summer, as soon as I could get up here, taking my shoes off for as long as I could, and with the lake right there, had a really ideal childhood. Grandma didn't drive. We had a milk truck that came and brought us milk and eggs once a week. And there were times when we'd be there for 2 or 3 weeks at a stretch, and we were there, nowhere to go, nowhere to get there. So,
okay. So then, okay, you grew up and then finished high school.
Mm-hmm.
Did you then move to Traverse City area? Or
not right away. I moved out east and lived in New Jersey, right across from New York City. In fact, remember seeing the World Trade Towers being built. Mm-hmm. I lived there for a couple of years and then moved to Ann Arbor. My sister lived in Saline, just out of Ann Arbor. And from there, I moved, got an apartment, went to school. And after a couple of years at Washtenaw Community College, my heart was up here, and this is where I wanted to live. And so I thought, well, what can I do? I loved science. I had studied botany and cerviculture at college, but I also didn't know how that would provide me a living, so I thought I'd go to nursing school. And that's why I moved up here.
Okay, your desire was to go into nursing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that got waylaid. My dear friend of 50-plus years, we are still friends today, she and her Volkswagen and backpack said, "Won't you please come with me?" I said, "I don't have any money." "Don't worry," she said, "I'll cover you." And we took off on a 2-month trip across country backpacking up in the mountains in every location we could possibly go, from the Sierras to the Rockies to the Cascades. And when I returned to start nursing school, I was 2 days late, and they turned me down and wouldn't let me start. And so I went to work at a hospital as a ward secretary and a nurse aide. And unfortunately, when I reapplied the following year, they didn't take me in, which was fine, because in that same time, within a couple of months of that time, I met Bill. So my life went off on a totally different trajectory.
So let's talk about that life changer. One night,
Yes. So the night, the first date we had, Bill decided to take us to the Sawmill, a bar that was in downtown Traverse City, about where Callie's Cottons was or is now. And I think it's rather prophetic that we ended up at a bar named the Sawmill as our first date.
Okay. What type of work was Bill doing at this time?
Bill was doing construction work, lots of house building.
Okay. So you had a discussion, a mutual dream of living off the land.
Yes.
Building your own home, yes. Etc.
So we this was in 1975 that we met, and we got a farmhouse on the south side of Traverse, and he started a business called Rooftop Chimney Sweep, and he would dress up in a tuxedo and top hat to go out and clean people's chimneys. This was when wood stoves were just having a big comeback, and so he was doing that as well as the construction work.
And then you married?
We married in 76, okay. So we're coming up on our 50th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
Next year, yeah.
Cool.
And we got married at the cottage on Crystal Lake, so just to keep that all
beautiful.
In the family.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then when did you purchased a piece of land after a few years?
Yes, it wasn't too long, but we were extremely frugal and found if we both worked, we could live off one paycheck and put the other one in the savings account. And we saved up enough money to for the down payment on the 52 acres there in Inland Township.
And that was purchased?
That was in 1977. We purchased it, and then we moved there along with the chickens and the cow in 1978.
Okay, can you describe that piece of property?
It was totally vacant. It had originally been the original homestead for the Clark family, and they later in years owned a grist mill and a sawmill in the river just at the foot of the hill. So there was about 12 to 15 acres of hardwoods, maybe 10 acres of cleared land, and the rest was in pines that was planted by Alexander Maley back in the early 50s, early to mid-50s. So there was no housing, there was no electricity, there was no water. We frequently used the river to wash up, and in the beginning we could get water from the artesian well in Honor and bring it back, but one of the first things we did was put in electric and have a well drilled. Okay. But we lived in a teepee. There was no home. And we had, that winter before we moved, we purchased a teepee from Blue Star in Montana somewhere. And Bill had a Native American friend that had access to lots of cedar poles. And so that became our home from April until mid-November of 78.
Okay.
So where would you go when it got cold enough? Would you go back to Traverse City at that point?
No, not. The only reason we went back to Traverse City is I finished driving school bus, and he was a school bus driver also in Traverse City. And so we finished out the school year before we moved to the teepee. But that was our sole home, and we had a wood stove instead of a fire on the ground. We put a wood stove right in the middle of the teepee and extended the pipe up so that the place wasn't filled with smoke when we had a fire to keep warm.
Sure.
And towards November, when it was getting cold, we'd heat water in buckets on the wood stove and take turns going outside and soaping up and dumping buckets of water over each other in order to bathe.
Okay, so
you would stay there right through the winter then?
No, that was about mid-November. Oh. And so the winter before we actually moved there with the teepee, we would come from Traverse with our log draw shaves, they're called, to peel bark off logs. And we started cutting all these pine logs and peeling them so that we could build our log cabin the next summer. We were young.
Sure.
We were mid-20s and thought we could do everything in a few months. So
So you started building.
So we started those logs. And then Bill worked for a construction company on the peninsula that was taking down migrant housing. It was just a few years after the cherry shaker had come into production. And so they weren't bringing in migrant workers as much. And Bill got walls from two of those migrant shacks. And in actuality, it said, Julio loves Maria on with a big heart on one of the walls of these migrant buildings, and he put it together. This was going to be our barn.
Okay.
And so we used some of the pine poles for structure and better build it ourselves.
So this is just a couple of years after the Mother Jones news started. So there was kind of a movement throughout the country where people were getting involved with this type of living. So
yes.
While it was kind of new to you, there's some people who are doing it already in different places.
Right, and we'd been subscribers to Mother Earth News and, you know, the Rodale Press, the prevention, alternative health magazines. And and Bill was extremely handy with all kinds of building construction techniques. So I was his helper.
He kind of reminds me a little of Harrison Ford from the Mosquito Coast, where he's in the middle of nowhere and can do anything with nothing.
That was about it. I mean, all our belongings were on pallets in the yard underneath plastic to keep it from, I mean, we had such a limited small space, so in that teepee we couldn't have things. Yeah.
So how did your barn turn into a tiny house?
Well, again, here came winter, and we had this barn standing here, and so it made more sense to move in that than to stay in a teepee, because when we had a wood stove, and Bill hooked up a hot water heating system over the wood stove that, you know, was in a hot water heater upstairs. Although that wasn't electrified, it was plumbed, and it was gravity feed for our hot water. We didn't have a bathroom. We had an outhouse. The building was 15 by 15 with a loft upstairs that you could only stand up in the very center, and we're pretty short. We had a woodshed with a window in it that looked from the house that looked into the woodshed right attached, and we just passed the firewood through the window to fill up the wood bin for our wood stove.
Okay, and then you had a surprise.
Yes, did have a big surprise. I found out I was pregnant and due in May with our first son, Aaron. And so that was an interesting winter, but towards the time he was to be born, we discussed very sincerely that we had to have a bathroom. There was no way we were going to have a baby without a bathtub and a toilet and a sink. So that went in just a few days before it was finished, just a few days before he was born. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Your husband and you were masters at reusing materials. Can you describe? I know you had the salvaged migrant housing. Yeah. Were there other things that during this time you...
Yes, there was. Besides growing all of our food, we also that summer had, and getting the electric and the water and putting that building up, we also dug a basement, just a small basement where we could store food, and we had to have a place for the extra tank for the well and such, and the electric box to come into. But that served also as our place to, we had a sauna in that basement space. So, and then besides, Bill had earned a contract to tear down and remove the old poorhouse, or I don't know what would be a better name for that.
County poorhouse.
Yeah, in Manistee County. Almost every county had a farm that was totally sustainable, and as did Manistee County. And this barn was massive and incredible. It was built by the state. And he and his friend Dick Gillen, with Dick's huge flatbed truck, tore down that barn and used all those materials, the beams, the siding. I pulled nails with Cindy Gillen for hours and hours on end to get materials that we could use. We had to stay there. Somebody had to stay there because people would come in and steal our lumber after we removed nails and stacked it up nicely. And
oh my goodness.
So we ended up having to one of us had to stay there. So that provided lumber for our parts of our sawmill. So Bill thought, well, we need to build a house. We need lumber. Let's get a sawmill. So he, with the log poles, we used that to support the sawmill. We bought an old bell saw, it was called at the time. So it wasn't a huge saw, but we could run pretty good-sized logs through it. And then the next step was we realized we can't do anything with green lumber. It just shrinks and twists, and we have to dry it. So using that, the wood and the that we got from the Manistee barn, he built a solar kiln, passive solar, which, you know, Michigan, we don't get a whole lot of sun. So it worked, but it took a long time. It was quicker than just stacking it, you know. And so then that just went from one thing to the next, and we built a small kiln with a dehydration system to actually pull the moisture out of the air, which pulled the moisture out of the lumber to dry it. That proved well, and then the next step was a machine shop that we built, quite large, with industrial-sized machinery.
And you're still living in a 700-square-foot tiny house.
Correct.
Where you're getting all these industrial complexes built on your property.
Yes, you got the picture, exactly. And then a dry kiln, the big dry kiln, which I forgot to check with Bill how many board foot that took, but it was many hours of stacking lumber, and he had front-end loaders, and we had three-phase electric put in also to run all this equipment, because you couldn't just run it on, right, you know, regular voltage. And we had, there bloomed a business, you know, and so we ended up with three kids in that 10 years.
Can you talk, first of all, for our listeners, we're talking with Denise Wrights about her experience homesteading, starting a lumber business, etc. And what I want to talk about right now is your organic living. You know, that you had a huge garden.
Yes, very huge garden. And it grew all our vegetables. I canned, I dried, I froze stuff. I made sauerkraut. And the kids helped with everything, and the garden, and they all garden to this day. And they also helped with the lumber business. They can tell many stories of in the middle of the night and, you know, hose busting on the loader and dry lumber spilling out into the snow. We all have to get up and help. And it was a close family thing. We were in that tiny house. We worked together. We had to. This was what got us what we needed to live.
Sure. So there's two things I want you to talk about.
Okay.
Going shopping.
Oh. Well, going shopping, when we were in the little place, the little house, was over to the basement that we had dug. And it had those old cellar doors that you flung open from the outside. So if it was wintertime, you had to shovel the snow off it before you could get to the stairs. And it was a good little walk across the yard in the snow, and I had quite a trail going. But I'd bring my wire basket and go down in the basement, and I had carrots and potatoes and cabbages and all the canned goods that I had put up, and the jams and the
And you also had
tomatoes, everything.
Apple cider?
Apple cider, yes. We had apple trees on a property that some of them are still producing apples that are at least 120 years old. They're really old. And we had a big chest freezer. We'd take them to Swanson's down in Bear Lake. There used to be an apple cider mill, and we'd bring just a pickup load full of apples and have enough apple cider squeeze to line the bottom of the big chest freezer for the winter.
So you end up with a total of three kids. So were there three kids living in the 700-square-foot house?
Yes.
All together?
Yes. For the youngest was four when we moved out of the little house, and Aaron was 10.
One more thing about organic. Mm-hmm. What'd you do for meat?
Well, originally we had the cow, but Bill's always been a hunter and a fisherman, so we live on venison and fish.
And you did have chickens.
We had chickens. But remember, we didn't even have a house. So the chickens kind of just happily lived the rest of their lives roaming around in the yard. And once a few little chicks showed up, But and we have eagles and hawks, and right. I think that's what happened to them.
So would you, did you have close by neighbors that you bartered with, or where did you get things like eggs and milk?
Yeah, we did. But mostly we relied on, if we didn't grow it, we'd have to go to the grocery store. But, you know, if you have to go and you're just buying milk and you're not buying your vegetables much or meat, your bill's not too high. So, yeah, that was a good...
Okay.
Another place where you had some reclaimed materials were from a resort in Traverse City, was it, where you got some thermal painted windows?
Oh, yes, yes. There was, again, at that time back in the mid-70s, it was a big push to use wood stoves and to reduce cost in to heating places. And there was a... I don't even know the name of it, some kind of a hotel that had three big plate glass windows in each room. And they took out two and left one. And Bill was able to buy a whole huge truckload, I'm talking a flatbed kind of truck, full of these windows. And he sold off, I still see them around the county here and there, these windows. And what was left after he broke even, we used in our house when we built the house, and in our shop building when we built that.
Okay. So over the course of that 10 years, you were always, were you working on the big house?
We were, yes, but slowly, because we were spending so much time on building the business and putting all that infrastructure in that the house sort of took back seat. Mm-hmm. And I was doing books and sales with Bill out in the yard and had the three kids to care for. And he was doing the rest of it, and we hired people on occasion. Okay. So
when did he get the nickname Sawmill Bill?
We have a dear friend, Dick Gillen and Cindy Gillen, who also helped us tear that barn down in Manistee. And Dick was quite a character, and he named Bill Sawmill Bill. So that's how he got the name. And that's what the business came to be called, Sawmill Bills. Yeah.
Okay. So what kind of products, you know, at your sawmill? Because
we were able to take somebody's logs. A lot of people were building houses, and they had to cut the logs down. They didn't want to just burn them up, and they brought them to us, and we'd turn them into whatever they wanted. So we'd saw it, give them flat stock, or, of course, this is after drying it. And we could make flooring, paneling, moldings of all sorts, and custom. Okay. So we had industrial-sized machine. Hence, we needed that three-phase to run everything.
Okay. So after 10 years, this whole production was all in on your property.
Correct.
Around.
Yes.
Until 1996?
Yes, 1996. So we moved into the house in 1989. And it was rather shocking to all of us because we were so used to being right there in this itty-bitty tiny place. And in fact, the bedrooms upstairs, we didn't have the wall, the drywall, and the wood up yet. And so I clearly remember us all saying goodnight to each other by just yelling across the open space upstairs. And
how big was that house?
2,300.
From 700 to 2,300.
Yes, it was enormous to us. It was just enormous to us. And Bill did all the woodwork for it. I helped, of course, but he... And we had neighbors and friends that helped us build. We even had a rock party where friends brought rocks from all over the world, actually. And we put that into our fieldstone fireplace. He had friends that came over. He'd have the walls all ready to lift. And we had a big work crew to help lift the walls and do it. But we just worked when we weren't having the business going. We worked on that house. And it took us 3 years of working full-time on that to get it to a point where we could move in. So, and then, back to 1989. We had a fire in our shop that burnt it right to the ground. Fortunately, none of our custom work was in there, so none of our customers lost their products.
Okay.
And it was devastating because that was our livelihood. And fortunately, we did have insurance through a Timberman's a company out of the UP. And with that money from the fire, we bought 13 acres on US 31 between Hatchery and Interlochen.
Oh, okay.
And just renamed it Sawmill Bill's Interlochen Wood Products. And there we, again, were building, because what had stood there was a small pole barn used as an antique dealer had it, and we put up a lumber storage shed so people could back their cars or trucks into it and pull the lumber that they selected off the walls. We had a big machine shop with huge upgraded, excellent machinery. And the third building was our son's Aaron's idea to keep the sawdust, the dried sawdust, and put it through a machine that compressed it without any other additives, just total sawdust. The compression of lignum in the wood makes it all stick together, and we produce these firewood bricks that we would sell. But I think we're a little ahead of the curve on that one.
So it's kind of a precursor to the pellet stoves, where you feed pellets into a stove. These bricks are larger and size of a brick.
Right. They were larger, and you could use them in your fireplace or your wood stove. I think the wood pellets had come out a little bit before, around the same time. Same idea, but for wood pellets, you'd have to buy a whole new stove to deal with wood pellets, where the bricks you could just place inside. And
so at this point, the sawmill, was that still at your property?
Yes, the sawmill and the dry kiln were still on our property.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it went down to the shop, and that's where it was made into all the different products you guys would sell.
And what we have is all the native woods, hardwoods and softwood. So there was cherry and ash and walnut and whatever kind of native trees are around that could be grown. So.
And these kind of woods were critical if you're going to be building with hard woods. Was there kind of a turn in the economy where people wanted to use just pine and to cover everything with drywall so you weren't using as much wood in construction as time went on?
I'm not sure. I think there's always been those people that have their heart in having wood in their homes and not just drywall, you know, if you could afford it. But
yeah,
I mean, we had a violin maker in Interlochen that would come out and select the tiger maple, the figured maple, for his violins. So there, it was a wide range of people. It wasn't just home builders.
Right.
I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, that's in pianos. I see that tiger wood, too, is very attractive.
Mm-hmm. So for our listeners, we're speaking with Denise Wrights, who has quite an amazing life. Starting a business, homesteading, making their own house, etc. So you had this very vibrant lumber company going on. Your kids, during this time, I'm curious about schooling. I mean, you didn't fit homeschooling in there.
No, we thought about it, but we didn't do homeschooling. They went to Benzie Central Schools. It was wonderful. There were such wonderful teachers, and many I'm still friends with to this day. Mm. And then their junior and senior years, they went to the Leelanau School up in Glen Arbor. We had close friends that let us know of scholarships that were available, and they were encouraging local kids to go, and it was an opportunity for them that I knew they would never have another chance like that. I mean, to visit China and to, you know, places and friends in Florida, and just the experiences of having three or four kids in a classroom. So, yeah, it was a great experience.
Okay, so then it kind of brings us to the recession of 2008, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that and the impact?
Well, there was also, when we started, there were no box stores around. And little by little, Lowe's, Home Depot, Menards, these bigger box stores had moved in that sold lumber at such a low price that it was hard for us to compete, and it put a lot of pressure on us. And that's when we could see the sad writing on the wall. And in 2008, that was the toughest time. And in 2010, we closed the business down. So we just couldn't keep it going.
But you and your husband are so resilient. That's where we get into the creative living. What did you do during this period?
There was some deep sorrow involved, let me tell you, And by this time, the kids are grown. And we had, Bill also has a pilot's license, and we had a small Cessna at the time. And
can you tell the story of that? You know, the gift you gave him, something he wanted.
Yeah, it was his 40th birthday, and he'd been talking about wanting to fly and for a long, long time. And so I had saved up some seed money, and I said, go, get your pilot's license. And those stories are a whole nother conversation, because there were so many incredible things we did and saw from seeing the United States from 2,000 feet in the air. Is just an amazing experience, wow. Out to Yellowstone and different places in Ocracoke. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. But so that helped.
So you returned to doing bookkeeping? Did you teach?
Right. Well, yeah. Before the, when we were down at the shop, Bill and I, really, we had been working together, building a house, raising kids for about, I don't know how many years, but a good 20 years probably. And we decided it was time for me to retire. So he bought me a gold watch, and we had a little party. And so there I was. So I thought, oh, great, I'll have some time off. And I happened to be down at the shop, and a friend of ours who owned a computer company in Traverse City, Vector Computer, Mark asked me, he saw me there, he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, I need a bookkeeper and a secretary. And I'd done bookkeeping now for a long time. I started out with paper spreadsheets before there were computers, and doing the taxes and whatnot. So he hired me, and I worked for Mark for 20 years. And in that term of time, he had the contract to take care of the computers at the Benzie Central Schools. And I taught computer classes at Platte River and at Lake Ann School for the elementary school kids. Wow. And I had a counterpart that covered the other two schools. So I've done a lot of different things. Yes. I've been a forester, and I've done just so many things.
Yeah. Talk about that forester. What was that job? Because that was like an on-the-job.
That was an on-the-job kind of training. I mean, I had experience in the woods and some schooling. And I just happened down to the fish hatchery, which is just a mile down the road, to see if they had any work available. And there was a young woman forester there, that said, yeah, we need another forester. Come with me and see what you can do. And so I spent a few days with her. And I don't remember the man's name, unfortunately. He was very dear. And he said to me, well, do you know how to thin carrots? And I said, you bet. I've been thinning carrots for years. He said, well, it's kind of the same thing. And so I did a consultant forestry for the USDA and timber improvement for homeowners. So I did that for the first summer. And then, remember, I got pregnant, had Aaron. I put him in a backpack, and we marked trees the next summer with this baby on my back.
You know, there was another way that you guys made ends meet, and it occurred during the summer high season. Can you describe that?
Right. So it really started out after we had moved out of the big house. And the house, the little place, had sat there for a few years with storage and stuff that never got moved out. And at work, a mutual friend had called Mark and said, do you know of anybody that has a cabin to rent? And I thought for a few seconds and said, sure, I do. I didn't realize the work I had cut out for me to get it prepared, but I knew I could do it. And so we started renting the little house. And then that worked so well, and we ran into some hard times when the business went down. And we were able to get a little travel trailer, and we moved out of our big home and rented our home through the summer, probably about 5 years renting the big house.
Wow.
It's very similar to the history of Frankfurt, where you have the big house in the front and you move into the back house during the summer months so you could rent it to some
people, from,
to
Chicago. People from Chicago.
Exactly. Yeah. But we moved into this travel trailer so we could rent both places.
That's great. Okay. So then now, okay, your son, Aaron, was in California. He came back home. And then he gave you a new idea.
Yes, yes. It was just a little while before he moved home. He said, "Mom, Dad, everybody out here is growing lavender. It's catching on like wildfire. Why don't you start growing lavender?" And he was very generous and fronted us the infrastructure. We had the equipment, tractors and plows and rototillers and so forth. And so we prepped and ordered 700 lavender plants. And this was in 2013. So that's when we started growing lavender, and we still grow it to this day. We have 1,000 plants now.
So your big garden then became a smaller garden, and the big garden was used for the lavender.
Well, no. We put the lavender in an area that was sunny all the time. So, and we did research and realized that what we wanted to grow was a French variety of lavender called Grosso, because it produces the most oil, and it's what's used in France for commercial production of oil.
So you use an organic method.
Totally organic. Our ground is totally organic. We have huge collection barrels for the rainwater off the roof, off the sawmill, and pumps to, if we need to water, we water with.
Okay. Yeah. So what's the process of harvesting and processing your 700 French lavender plants?
It's all hand done. There's no mechanized way. I think they've come up with it now, but we're small. We're so small. But at the time, when we started, there was that lavender farm, Lavender Hill between Petoskey and Charlevoix, and there were some young folks in the peninsula, the Old Mission Peninsula, the base of the peninsula, had torn out cherry trees and put lavender in. There were no other lavender farms around. We had just started this one. And so the process then is you have to have the correct part of the year. It has to be mid-July to first week in August. The plants need to be 70% in bloom, and you go out by hand and cut with these small little sickles, handfuls at a time, and then gather these all up and bring them to the still. We have a steam distilling process with a copper basket.
Okay, tell us about that. That came from
Oh, well, yeah, that's everything has a little story to it.
Well, by the way,
our youngest son had dabbled in making beer. In fact, he made all the beer for his sister Sarah's wedding and bottled it, and we all got together and came up with names. Anyway, so he also had dabbled in making some kind of liquor. I don't know, vodka, or I'm not even sure what it was. And so the process is similar. And that I don't know how you make liquor, but what we do, we use that same machinery to steam distill the lavender and collect the oil and the hydrosol from the plants. So he just passed his equipment on to us.
That's cool. So what products do you make?
Well, the biggest one is the oil. Okay. And it's quite astounding that out of those 700 plants, if we get 3, maybe close to 4, but never more quarts of oil, that's an excellent year. Mm-hmm. So, and in that process of making the oil, we create hydrosol, which has the same properties as the oil, but it's lighter. It's what you can spray on your skin, on your bedding, on to sanitize, because it has the same antibacterial, antimicrobial properties that the oil does, and the relaxing properties. So that you can spray that on your skin. It's excellent on sunburns and bug bites. And it, besides the antiseptic properties, it just helps calm it. I worked for a doctor in Traverse City for a few years too. She was a holistic functional medicine doctor. And she had a small outbreak of shingles and used the hydrosol on her shingles and thought it was amazing. Wow. She had to reapply it. It's a natural product. And of course, everything I'm saying, you need to check with your doctor before
Absolutely.
You do anything.
Thank you. So, yeah. So where do you bring your goods?
So our biggest is the Alberta and the Frankfurt Farmers Market in the summertime, the spring, summer, and through in the fall. And we also sell at Bedazzled at St. Ambrose. We've been friends with Sharon Jones and Kirk for many years, and we had honeybees in our backyard at the same time. They went honey and we went lumber. Also, Oriana and Traverse City, the Lake Street store carries our products. And Yoga for Health in Traverse City has our products also. Okay. So Oriana, Bedazzled, and Yoga for Health. We don't sell out of our house. Some people have a setup when they have people come in and cut their own lavender. We're kind of into the protection. When the lavender's ready, we cut it all and process it. So, and we sell it in those places.
So you don't do mail order, website?
Yeah, if people have contacted me, and I'm more than happy to mail out, but I don't have a website. Again, we're quite small.
Sure.
And I want product for our local community, so it's the two farmers markets, and last year we ran out.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a good thing and bad at the same time. Yeah. So, yeah.
I just have one question about the harvesting. Mm-hmm. What time of day?
Oh, it has to be in the afternoon when the sun, a sunny day, 70% in bloom, and the one and only problem I can think of is the bees want that lavender at the same time we do. So we have to get it, and it's only a couple of weeks of harvest time, and we're done.
Wow.
So, but the bees kind of get concentrated as we cut the lavender. They go to all the other plants that are still in bloom, and so towards the end, the bushes are just full of bees.
Wow. Yeah. So when you cut it, or, you know, use the sickle, mm-hmm. do you have to tie it off? Do you hang them until you
Well, a lot of it or? I do for okay. a flower, because I have flower products, too. I didn't talk about that. We have, I take flowers and make sachets, and mm-hmm. I hand paint some sachet bags, and mm-hmm. I have wool dryer balls that I infuse with lavender oil, and so I hang, oh, geez, I don't know. I never counted. I have to hurry up and get it in because Bill just cuts it and processes it. I'll leave you these plants. But
oh, he'll
you know,
immediately start yeah, I've got doing
a,
the
Oh,
distilling.
We do it immediately. We don't dry our lavender.
Oh, okay. That was my, what I, okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. So I dry some for flowers, but when we're processing and cutting, we run it all through. We're done. When we're done processing, we pack up the equipment until next year. So,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can ask the last.
You know, this whole idea of sustainability and small houses and all that, it seems to be making a comeback. We've got some fictive kin in the area that's took a semi-trailer back and turned it into a house, and now he's trying to get it onto some land.
Yeah, after my heart, yeah.
Right well, we might send
too.
Him your way
yeah.
because he's in the process of the road building into the lot he bought.
So if he could see somebody that's at the end of the road, then he'll know something is possible. Because right now it looks kind of discouraging with all the underbrush and having to go through all these steps. He might not have as much open area as you do to start with.
Yeah, and as we talk, it all sounds so very romantic. But it was one heck of a lot of hard work from daybreak until we collapsed to sleep. You know?
Sometimes a dream can turn into a nightmare, and you just got to live through and get to the next day of a dream.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to have that dream and that sight, right? You've got to have that goal in sight so you can head towards it. But no, it wasn't easy. But who cares? Mm-hmm. We've had a wonderful life. Yeah. Lots of ups and downs, but who doesn't, you know?
There you go.
Yeah.